You're late.
Missy and I kept talking, and I didn't realize how late it got.
You missed a very dull TV show about Auschwitz. More gruesome film clips, and more puzzled intellectuals declaring their mystification over the systematic murder of millions. The reason why they can never answer the question, how could it possibly happen, is that it's the wrong question. Given what people are, the question is, why doesn't it happen more often? Of course it does, in subtler forms.
I have a little headache from this weather.
Oh. It's been ages since I sat in front of the TV. Just changing channels to find something. You see, the whole culture. Nazis, deodorant salesmen, wrestlers, beauty contests, the talk show. Can you imagine the level of a mind that watches wrestling? Huh? But the worst are the fundamentalist preachers. Third-rate con men telling the poor suckers that watch them that they speak for Jesus. And to please send in money. Money, money, money. If Jesus came back and saw what's going on in his name, he'd never stop throwing up.
The wolf on the hill is never as hungry as the wolf climbing the hill.
Lone wolf is a term commonly used by many people. It means that they used to belong to a group, but left, to become stronger. By thinking and acting alone, the lone wolf acquires superior cunning, agility, imagination and skills unknown to members of the pack. The lone wolf is independent of and distances itself from the petty bickerings, expectations, demands, mediocrities and unfulfilled dreams of other people, groups or organizations. The lone wolf is often branded as the rebel.
For it is the sovereign lone wolf who stands alone in all of his or her glory. You are listening to Lone Wolf Radio, presented and hosted by Tom Metzger. Tom is now broadcasting from a newly relocated and improved bunker in an undisclosed location with internet access across the globe. So sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode on Lone Wolf Radio.
Hello, boys and girls. Terrible Tommy here. Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in on the West Coast now, of course. And we are at 315 East Esplanade Avenue, P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, 92583. I hope we're not going to have to change this again. No, we're going to keep this one a while. And it is Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. The 14th of June, of Juni, as they'd say in Germany. I love that Max Sydow's cut we played at the beginning of the show. I love it. In fact, I think he's one of the great actors. I've watched him in a lot of movies, and he's always done very well in all of them. But the question is, why doesn't it happen more often? But it does in so-called smaller versions, but probably larger versions than they pretend that it happened, because you and I know, and the Red Cross knows, and most people who really dig into it know that nowhere near 6 million Jews died in the N-word, no, not the N-word, the H-word fracas. There's been a lot worse genocide among other peoples around the world, but they don't have a good press corps like the Jews do. Well, how do you like the ISIS attack over in England this morning? Yeah, the giant apartment building in flames, and they're not saying it's terrorist or guerrilla warfare, but you and I know it is, because that hotel, that apartment building is full of Muslims and Negroes. So, you guessed it. As far as congressmen and politicians being shot at, it's a miracle that doesn't happen more often. You see, we had a taxpayer go crazy down in Alexandria, Virginia, and took a shot at the politicians. Everybody's shocked. I'm not shocked. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often than every day.
I guess I better turn my microphone around here so you can hear me, but I'm not going to redo that whole front of the show. No way. Well, that candy-ass Attorney General Sessions talked it over yesterday, and he got a little excited a couple of places. I'm surprised. He's such a milquetoast. And I'm surprised that Trump didn't get rid of him, and I'm surprised that he chose him to be Attorney General in the first place. I guess it's just because Sessions supported him for a long time. But just because somebody supported you for a long time is not a real good reason to make him Attorney General, since he's such a wimp. And believe me, if he got anything on any of you or me or us, we'd be in the darkest part of the prison. Because those are the Republicans are the ones that are putting people away for the most time. You realize that? You know, I can't understand why the right wing idolizes the Republican Party. Because they're number one in shipping jobs out of the country. Yes, they were, through the National Chamber of Commerce and even as far back as Richard Nixon. So even though we don't like the Democrat progressives, I mean, the Republicans are bigger rats in the long run to the white race. It can be turned around, but not with the Republican Party at the helm. And they're going to, if you do something they don't like, they're going to put you in a slammer for as long as they can. Look at poor old Richard Scutari. He should have been out 40 years ago, or at least 20 years ago. And they're leaving blacks out much faster than that. Now they're going to make him go for his whole sentence. He's going to have to do the whole 9 yards. And he's a model prisoner too. So every time you think about supporting Republicans or any politician, think of that. Don't give me that bullshit that the Republican Party, they have our back because once in a while one of them happens to say something racial. That's bullshit. The Republicans are just as much and maybe more dangerous to you than even the Democrats. And certainly not as dangerous to you like with the blacks. The blacks are maybe dangerous to you on the street level, and some of the blacks who've been given cushy jobs in Congress, things like that, by white Republicans, those kind you have to watch out for. But rank and file? Nevertheless, both political parties, or all political parties, are your enemy, some more than others. And if you think they're not, you're in the wrong outfit. It says here on the web, getting Trump elected was not Putin's goal. The Kremlin just wanted to sow discord and delegitimize the United States democratic institutions. Mission accomplished. Well, Putin didn't have to get involved with that. We'd do it fine among ourselves, man. Yeah. Poor Putin. They're going to have a big interview show about him, I guess this week on one of the pay channels. Might be interesting to watch. 4 hours, I think, or four nights. Now, what I just read was out of a Jewish electronic magazine, so take that with a grain of salt, too. But I think they're correct about this. Well, let's read you a letter from one of our people, one of our POWs, in fact, one of the people that we do our best to support. Dear Brother Tom, mighty white loyalist greetings to you, sir, as always. I have received your recent letter, and my account reflects your generosity once again. Thank you very much. After what I've been through, receiving mail is a relief and a pleasure, and your letters are particularly appreciated. But I will not forget what I've been through in this prison. You said that you are preparing to move back to California. This letter is a little older. Well, I'm sure that you have your reasons, but to me, California seems like an enemy stronghold. Hectic and expensive, too. I think I would prefer Indiana. Well, I'll tell you, George, being behind enemy lines is an interesting operation, especially when you know you're completely behind enemy lines and you can act accordingly. Indiana is sort of sneaky that way. You got a lot of white people in the county I was in. It was 90-some% white. But their brains were not 90-some% white. Their brains were mishmash of pro-Jew, Jew-Christian, and blacks are okay, and we want them to come in here. And they welcomed all the foreign people. They imported about 90,000 Somalians into a town about 50 miles from where I lived. So on the surface, it might have seemed a lot better than it really was. When will we get a president with a fresh set of ideas? Well, you're not going to get that. That's not going to happen. The system is too corrupt and too far gone. And for that matter, we never really did have one like that. You name me one president that was full bore pro-white in this century or the last century. You know, I had a moment of hope when the polls closed. But 100 days in, it's already clear that Trump is just another militarist. Well, that's for sure. More guns, more bombs, more ships, more planes, more killing. Korea? Are you serious? Who cares? It's 10,000 miles away. But I blame the media. They keep breathlessly reporting every nonsense threat of the clown with the ridiculous haircut. The idea of a sentinel, a carrier group that seems like senseless provocation or escalation. The idea of sending a carrier group seems like a senseless and expensive provocation. It's the same idiotic policy the USA has had towards Libya. It's the militarists that do that crap, the generals. But the politicians, I say the politicians are right behind them, because no general can march without the okay of a politician. And I note that Trump loves generals. It's like the 1950s all over again, like the Cold War 60s also. Trump should tell the world, no more threats by Korea, or we will take immediate action. Or, just note that we have enough firepower in one submarine to turn North Korea into a parking lot, and ignore the news from the point from that point on, saying Korea is not a credible threat. What are they going to do to invade? Well, you see, George, we set up the whole thing with the Korean War. On the ruse of fighting communism, we killed 1 million Vietnamese, no, Koreans, and split the country in two. We'd have been better off to let the North have it than what we've gone through and the expense we've made. And so it's a capitalist haven there in South Korea. And that's where all your jobs went. Korea and Vietnam and China. So why would we care if they get in a fight and destroy each other? Why would we give a damn if the Cupid doll in North Korea attacks South Korea and shuts down capitalist plants and so forth that have taken your jobs? I don't understand the logic, because the trouble is everybody seems to rally around the politicians when they want to go to war. They don't think about it, which makes me think they're not very smart. Saw they had a rehash of the LA riots on TV last night. Occurred just before my trial. Doomed me. Jurors knew that there would be riots in Jacksonville if I were found not guilty. Local posers openly redirected that, predicted that. But I hope some people associated with my case saw Reginald Denny Gatell dragged out of, Reginald Denny got dragged out of his vehicle up in L.A. and beaten half to death with a brick. Didn't happen to me, because George shot the guy. Came at him with a brick and he shot the guy. Obviously, Jews by perjury, what's the others could do by force. I have just completed 40-plus page complaints against each of the three parole commissioners. We'll file them with the Florida Commission on Ethics. No expectations. They're all JOG, Jewish Occupational Government. I'm just tilting at windmills. Well, but George, at least you're trying. But hell, you never know. I can't even get a pen that writes with black ink. This gray print drives me nuts. It's a declining empire, Tom. Signs are everywhere. Well, that's good. It's a slow process, and our people are stupid, indifferent anyway. But let's keep doing what we can. That will be our legacy, Rahoa. Gotta go, please. Stay in touch and say hello to all your supporters. And again, thanks for everything. Always your friend in the struggle, George. So there he is. He's been in there now for, I think, 25 years. He's still got more to go. Just because he defended himself from a nigger. A nigger. Do you hear that out there? All these creeps that are going to be able to get a hold of this show and listen to it and say, oh my God, he called him a nigger. Well, he was a nigger. He attacked this man with a brick. He was sitting in his car in a shopping center, and this nigger attacked him with a brick. He pulls out a gun, blows the nigger's head off, and he gets a life sentence. That's why you should hate every inch of this system. If you think there's any of this system that's going to be on your side, even when you defend yourself in self-defense, you're crazy. They're out to get you. They're adapting new laws all the time to placate the Negroes. They're not really helping the Negroes, but the Negroes don't realize that. And you know, the ones who really don't realize it are Negro women. They get the crapped on worse than anybody in the black community. But most of them don't realize that. Anyhow, that was a good letter from George, and we'll continue to support George till the very end. Incidentally, George was an active member of the Classes Church. He's a creator. I wonder how much support he's getting from the creators out there, you know. Most guys that go into prison, whether they're National Socialists or Klansmen or creators or whoever, don't get hardly any support and certainly no money. And that tells you something about a struggle, a movement. If you don't pick up your wounded and try to help them the best you can. And when they're in prison, the only thing you can do is write to them, send them books and so forth, and send them money for their commissary so they can eat decent food, because most of the food now in these prisons is not high quality at all. So anyhow, in fact, the prison this guy's in, they have a hard time even getting shoes. They got to buy their own shoes. Like I recommended a while back, and we got to follow through on this, all these privately owned prisons, I want you guys to buy stock in these privately owned prisons and then donate it to the prisoner. That way, while he's doing time, he's making money. Makes sense to me. I'm not sure what the stock runs on. There's one great big company that owns a majority of these private prisons. So I'm going to get my, I got a friend who's a lawyer, get him on and see how much we can buy stock. Yeah, you don't have to buy, you know, thousands, but if you bought one share every month and donated it to the POW, look how that would embarrass the prison people and the establishment. That would really embarrass the shit. And then when the press got a hold of it, they'd make it big, you know. Now what if all the people, the blacks and everybody that's in prison, did the same thing? I think that would be a great propaganda piece. And I'm going to do it, and you better do it too. If not, don't ever darken my bathtub again. You know, some of these creeps are attacking Putin, and of course, there's many reasons you can attack Putin over in Russia, but now they're trying to spread the rumor that he's secretly gay, a queer. Putin is a pedophile, they say now. There's been a slow-motion coup, and Putin is now just a figurehead, so they're circulating all this kind of bullshit, too. I'm sorry, boys and girls, I can't really support anyone who is a KGB officer. I can't do it, because I had too many people that I've read their stories of how they were beaten and tortured in East Germany and in the Soviet Union. And that's like supporting the FBI. In fact, it's worse than supporting the FBI. Think about it. Think of all the white people that were brutalized and tortured in the Soviet Union and East Germany and places like that. Think about it. Well, here's a great announcement. The head of the astronomy department at the University of Arizona believes that we are less than two decades away from finally finding alien life in space. Quote, I put my money on detecting microbial life in 10 to 15 years. The professor, what was his name? Professor Chris Impey told the website Futurism. Quote, but not at all detecting intelligent life, unquote. That caveat concerning intelligent life may disappoint UFO enthusiasts, but he noted that the discovery of even microbial life would have enormous implications for humankind. I'm waiting with bated breath for one of those microbial items to come along. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the reaction of a lot of folks in the military once they get out. You know, it's sort of like you don't know how good you've got it till it's gone sort of thing.
Exactly. How safe did you feel at some of these places, like Afghanistan and Iraq, when you were embedded there as a reporter?
I mean, you're obviously aware that there's a risk most of the time that you're there, but only when the troops I was with were under fire, I suppose was it sort of at the very front of my mind. Once the improvised explosive device threat, the IED threat, became very significant in both countries, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, then it was also in the back of your mind when driving around, say, Baghdad or the more dangerous parts of Afghanistan in military military convoys. I suppose in the back of your mind, you're just hoping that that the convoy doesn't drive over an IED.
That's right. Explain for us, if you would, JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command.
Yes. The Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC as it's usually known, is the command that runs the most secret missions, most secret special operations missions that the United States military undertakes, and it's the command that controls and has sort of nested underneath it, if you like, the most secretive, sensitive special operations units. So that's units like the Army's Delta Force and the Navy's SEAL Team 6, to use two of the best known examples. I sort of like to say that the U.S. public is aware, typically, of a lot of JSOC operations. They just don't know that those operations are run by JSOC. So, I mean, the capture of Saddam Hussein in Iraq in 2003 was a JSOC operation. The killing of Osama bin Laden was a JSOC operation. The rescue of Captain Phillips, who was kidnapped by Somali pirates. Yeah, that was a JSOC operation, and numerous others. Some not always the highest, not always the most successful ones. That when Pat Tillman, Ranger, who had been a professional football player, was killed. He was killed on a JSOC operation as well.
Wasn't he killed by friendly fire?
He was. That was the eventual determination that was that he had been killed by friendly fire.
Who puts together the special operations group or the command?
Well, it was created in 1980 as a reaction to the failure of Operation Eagle Claw, which was the attempt to rescue the American hostages in Tehran, and if you recall, that came to grief when some helicopters that were part of the mission not enough of the helicopters were able to make it to a rendezvous point in Iran called Desert One. One of those that did make it, after the mission had been postponed and they were getting ready to try again the next night and get out of Iran, crashed into C-130 plane, and several American service members were killed in that, and it was a very humiliating event for the United States. And when the after action reviews were done of that, it was decided that throwing a piecemeal task force together like that, full of organizations that weren't used to, and individuals who weren't used to working together, wasn't the way to go, and that it would be better to have a permanent headquarters that could run missions like this, when called upon, and didn't have such a steep learning curve. And that was why JSOC was created.
The name of the book, Relentless Strike, tells it all. How relentless are they?
These days, they're very relentless. I mean, one of the themes of my book is that in the post 9/11 era, not only has Joint Special Operations Command become the supported effort, the main military effort in the war against or the campaigns against Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, but that it has to become that, it has had to morph from an organization that was geared to run very short operations, counterterrorism operations with little to no notice. So think about responding to an airplane hijack, a cruise ship hijack, an attack on a U.S. embassy somewhere. And JSOC was sort of geared to do that, and an operation that might be over in a couple of days. to now it is having grown substantially in the last 15 years. It is now running campaigns around the world 24/7, 52 weeks a year with task forces in Afghanistan and the Horn of Africa and Yemen and in the Iraq-Syria theaters, just as examples.
How, when you say they're almost around the clock, but are they actively engaged in military conflict?
Yes, they are. I mean, just to give you recent examples, there was a January raid in Yemen just a few days after President Trump took office that was quite controversial. A lot of questions being asked about, whether it went through the right type of vetting before it was launched, given how new his administration was, and a SEAL Team 6 operator was killed in that mission. Another one has been killed since then in a mission in Somalia. That's just in the last few months they've lost men in combat.
Sean, I would guess the Russians probably have their own unit too, don't they?
Oh yeah, they have a lot of special operations forces. I mean, the general name for their ground special operations forces is Spetsnaz. So they do have a sort of a special mission unit, if you like, the equivalent of a Delta Force. They've been getting better at special operations as we've seen with the sort of the deployment of their special operations forces in Crimea, which is essentially one big laboratory and exercise field for Russian special ops.
Will these groups, the special command, ever be called on, let's say, to take out the leader of North Korea?
I couldn't say no, but I would doubt it, just because of how difficult an operation that would be
to get to him.
I beg your pardon?
You mean how difficult it would be to get to him?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you're talking about a very militarized society, very heavily defended country, an awful lot of integrated air defense systems there. So while I'm sure if you asked JSOC to put a plan together to do that, then they would put their heads together and come up with a plan that they thought might have a chance of working. I think that the likely efforts, if it was decided that taking out the head, the leadership of North Korea was what the United States wanted to do, I suspect that would be done with airstrikes or missile strikes would be more likely.
Is this command doing anything to combat ISIS at all?
Yes. Oh, yes. It absolutely is. For a start, remember that the Islamic State is the sort of the descendant organizationally of the group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which JSOC basically all but destroyed between 2004 and 2010, 2011 time frame. When that group sort of morphed into the Islamic State, a lot of which happened in Syria, and then came back through Iraq in 2014, overrunning a large part of Iraq, JSOC immediately was sent back into action. It had a task force, which at the time was called Task Force 27, based out of Erbil in the Kurdish part of northern Iraq, and centered around Delta Force. Most JSOC task forces are centered around one of its component units. Delta Force has traditionally had the sort of the anti-Islamic State, anti-Al-Qaeda in Iraq mission. And they've been working with local forces ever since then. Pretty much most of the time that you hear that an Islamic State senior figure has been killed in an airstrike, the smart betting would say that that's a JSOC mission, or at least that the targeting of that individual was done by JSOC.
We're going to talk more about this, Sean, when we come right back. Sean Naylor, our guest, his book is called Relentless Strike. Next hour, we'll take Coast to Coast. Sean Naylor with us, Relentless Strike, The Secret History of Joint Special Operations Command. He is our special guest. We'll take calls with Sean next hour. I have always been fascinated with how this works, Sean, and you were right there. You witnessed it. Could you tell us a few stories that you might have been able to report on or you saw?
Certainly. Although I want to make sure that I clear one thing up. Although I've spent a lot of time embedded with the U.S. military and with special operations units, Joint Special Operations Command doesn't embed any reporters in their operations, because they are so secret. At least that would be the approach that that would be the excuse that they would use. I personally think that they ought to do that, but to my knowledge, they've never embedded anybody. But some of the more extraordinary missions that I was able to uncover while researching Relentless Strike include several years of that, and you know, presumably still going on now that that JSOC forces are almost openly in Syria, but several years of undercover operations in Syria after the invasion of Iraq, and these were sort of a rare type of spy mission in which the most dangerous work was actually done by the Americans, not by local hires. Began as early as 2003, before the Iraq invasion, when one of JSOC's more secretive organizations, sometimes known as Task Force Orange, infiltrated undercover operatives into Syria. And after the invasion, I mean, these spies and those who followed provided invaluable intelligence to the United States on the foreign fighter networks, the jihadist networks that were flowing into Iraq from Syria. And these missions really involved classic sort of old school espionage, changing into disguise, sort of in changing disguises mid-mission to throw off any tail, using lockpick kits to break into Al-Qaeda safe houses, copying everything they could find in those safe houses on digital devices and notebooks, then retreating, sometimes setting up secret cameras overlooking the doors of those safe houses so that they could track arrivals and departures, and, you know, doing all of this, you know, and having to be cool as ice while doing it. In one instance that I know of, one operative had a recording device. Basically, the battery basically melted down in his pants while he was riding on Syrian public transport, and he just had to sort of like play it cool as it burned his leg badly enough to leave a scar. And you know, this, the material that they got out of Syria was then sometimes after some digital tweaking, used in sort of the United States' diplomatic hard bargaining with Syria's Bashar al-Assad regime to sort of say, look, we know that that you've got jihadists coming through your country and killing Americans and Iraqis in Iraq, and we have the pictures to prove it. Or we sometimes they might say we took this material off of a foreign fighter that we captured, when in fact that material had been taken from an al-Qaeda safe house by an American serviceman in Syria. So I mean that's one of the operations that that I was able to uncover. Another one involved the use of reverse engineered improvised explosive devices, IEDs, by JSOC themselves. And they called
How would that work?
They called these the Xbox device is actually what they called it. It's got nothing to do with the computer game, but they called it the Xbox device, and it grew out of Delta Force and SEAL Team 6's sort of technical experts who had been taking apart Taliban, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, IEDs from Afghanistan and Iraq to see how they were made. And eventually they realized, hey, you know, we could make these ourselves. So that's what they did. And they were used in particular as a way to take out Shiite targets in Iraq. If you'll recall, most of the fighting and the main enemy in Iraq during the counterinsurgency campaigns there were the Sunni insurgent groups, and in particular Al Qaeda in Iraq itself. But the Shiite groups that were supported by the Iranian regime in Tehran actually killed a lot of U.S. and coalition forces themselves, particularly using something called the Explosively Formed Penetrator, or EFP, which was a very powerful IED. Well, JSOC wanted to take out the key people in that network, but the Shiite government of Iraq under Nouri al-Maliki was reluctant to let them attack Shiite militias. And as a result, they needed a way of doing this that left no U.S. fingerprints on the operation. So they would put these IEDs together using all locally sourced material, just as if they were, they had been made by Iraqis. And then, again, you needed very daring individual actions to, for instance, emplace these IEDs in the cars of the targets that they were going after. But unlike the Iraqi insurgents, either Sunni or Shiite, there were specific rules that were attached to by the U.S. government to JSOC's use of the Xbox device, and one of those was that it had to be targeted towards an individual and set off by a command detonation. It couldn't be an IED that you roll, that a car rolls over and it explodes. It had to be command detonated by an American with eyes on the target, which obviously puts the American in some peril. Obviously also just in placing those IEDs puts the Americans in some peril. So it usually involved Delta's reconnaissance experts surveilling a target for days on end, building a pattern of life for that target so that they knew, for instance, maybe his car is always left alone in the garage between...
Sounds like the mob, Sean, doesn't it?
I beg your pardon?
Sounds like the mob.
Not everybody in JSOC was particularly happy with using this technique. And, I was told by a former senior SEAL Team 6 official that Team 6, although they'd been involved with the development of this, actually didn't, decided in the end not to use it. And I mean, that gentleman said to me that it was a great tool, but he said, we're not different than the enemy if we're just blowing people up with booby traps. Now, other people would say, hey, look, whether a guy dies in an explosion that we set off in his car, or he dies in an explosion from, a missile fired by a helicopter or a plane, doesn't make much difference. So there were different schools of thought on that.
Do these Special Operations Command, do they also set foot on the United States to protect us here, and we just don't know much about it?
Well, of course, the units are all based here. Delta Force is at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Okay.
SEAL Team 6 is at Dam Neck, which is in the Virginia Beach area of Virginia. And JSOC headquarters is also at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And the other units are spread around the country. But they do have some domestic responsibilities. One of JSOC's missions that has attached itself to JSOC from fairly soon in after JSOC's creation in the early 1980s, it's been a sort of counter weapons of mass destruction proliferation mission. Now most of that involves trying to figure out what to do abroad to sort of interrupt the supply chains of terrorists getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction, but there is a part of it that involves how to protect U.S. government officials and how to respond to, say, an act of sort of nuclear hostage taking. If somebody shows up, a terrorist shows up in Washington and says, you know, I have a nuclear weapon in my, strapped to my body, and unless you do X, Y, or Z, I'm going to blow up the White House or the Capitol or something like that. There are JSOC personnel, assigned to respond to that. A lot of that mission ended up belonging to SEAL Team 6, as a matter of fact. I think partly because they're they are closer than Delta Force to the National Capital Region.
I suspect, Sean, that they're doing many things that we just don't even know about. We probably couldn't even pick the tip of the iceberg on this.
I think you're right, and it's interesting you use the phrase tip of the iceberg, because that's often how I describe why I wrote Relentless Strike, which is that although this force, this command, was the main effort in the global war on terror, or whatever we're calling those campaigns now, and had been since not long after 9/11, the government really wasn't telling the American people much about the main effort. It's as if the government during World War II decided not to tell the American people about Patton's Third Army as it was racing across Europe. So I wrote the book to try to illuminate at least a substantial chunk of the rest of the iceberg that was being hidden from the American people.
Did they try to kill Osama bin Laden years before 9/11?
Yes, yes, they did, or at least they
thought about it.
They had plans to kill Osama bin Laden, and they got very close to launching this. I describe in my book two abortive efforts to do that. One was in 1998, when Delta Force spent 2 weeks drawing up a plan to snatch bin Laden by inserting operators and vehicles onto a dry lake bed near bin Laden's compound just outside of Kandahar in Afghanistan, and then either seizing him at home or ambushing his convoy on the road between Kandahar and a town in eastern Afghanistan called Khoust. And, you know, there were, you know, if they decided to ambush the convoy, Delta Force would have provided the ground force and six or eight SEAL Team 6 snipers riding on tiny little bird helicopters, as they call them, flown by the 160th. Special Operations Aviation Regiment would have had the mission to stop Bin Laden's vehicle using sort of sniper rounds. And what I was told was that the SEALs had already boarded a plane containing the Little Bird helicopters and their crews at Oceana Naval Air Station, which is down near Damneck, Virginia, and they were preparing for takeoff to conduct that mission when they got the word that it had been scratched. And it was only after that that Al-Qaeda then attacked the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, killing more than 200 people. So that was 1998. Then a year later, in 1999, Delta planned to target Bin Laden again. And this time the mission was simply to kill him. There was no discussion of capturing him. And four undercover Delta operators would infiltrate Afghanistan, identify Bin Laden using binoculars, and then call in either a smart bomb from a jet or Hellfire missiles flown by Little Bird helicopters again to kill him. And, you know, they would have gotten those Little Bird helicopters into position by landing a special operations version of the C-130 Hercules called a Combat Talon on a dry lake bed that they had picked out in southeastern Afghanistan. So that mission was rehearsed at White Sands Missile Range in the American Southwest. And that also got scratched eventually by the Clinton administration.
John, there's concern about suitcase nukes getting snuck into the country. Would this kind of command be searching for stuff like that too?
To my knowledge, they wouldn't be searching for it in the sense of like a customs force. I think there are other government organizations that if it hasn't been detected by the time it arrives at a port, that would do that. But they certainly would have the mission if, say, a terrorist organization was, if intelligence indicated that a terrorist organization was going to try to do that, and there was any actionable intelligence as to where that suitcase nuke was or who might know about it abroad, there's a good chance that JSOC would be involved in taking apart that plot and very possibly seizing the device itself and taking care of it.
Without this kind of command, what would we have in terms of capability? Not much?
Well, I think we'd have a need to create it. Obviously, the United States military is an extraordinary force, and it is the most powerful military that's ever been created. But what JSOC, and most of those forces are not in Joint Special Operations Command. But the reason that JSOC has risen so much to the fore in recent years is that it provides commanders a way of conducting combat operations without it being very public. All the time that we've heard administrations say, oh, we don't have boots on the ground in this country or that country, when there are, hundreds of JSOC operators on the ground in those countries involved in combat operations. It's got a political advantage, and of course, it was set up as a specialist counterterrorism command, and we've been fighting terrorists since 9/11. We've been
at war with terrorists
since 9/11, and so it's come to the fore for that reason as well.
All right, we're going to come back.
Relentless Strike is the name of the book. This is for your information, and I hope you know how to read between the lines, because if you're in this business, if you don't know how to read between the lines, you don't know what the hell's going on. It's not only reading, but reading between the lines. Now, you know, this outfit, see, these are policemen of the world. Now, these outfits have become cops of the world. And you, as you know, as a country becomes more authoritarian, it will not cease to, or not cease and desist from using deadly violence on their own people. Now, let's go on down the road a little bit. Maybe a decade or two decades, maybe. Maybe more, but I doubt it. When uprisings will begin in this country, as the country divides and breaks up, you're going to be all kinds of factions. And guess who's going to be coming after you? Now, whether you can turn these people into our friends or they're going to be adversaries, we don't know at this point. But by that time, there's going to be more and more non-whites in these groups. And so it's going to be harder and harder to turn them effectively. But the Middle Eastern people seem to do it okay, so I guess it's possible. But just remember, whatever he's talking about they use overseas, they will not hesitate to use here when the conditions are right. And if you think otherwise, you're in la-la land. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. But make sure you think about what you heard today and share it with our friends.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. You better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop.
I did what I did for the good of the realm. The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed. tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left once we abandon the lie? Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail, but never get to try again. Fall breaks them. And some, given a chance to climb, they refuse. They cling to the realm. Or the gods. Or love. Illusions.